Walter Bradley. Dr. Halstead, can I ask you that the interesting comparison, obviously, with the risk factors is between those who don't develop post-polio syndrome by the time you're looking at them and those that that do. You've made a comparison between those who have a risk factor and don't have a risk factor. Obviously, the problem is to get a whole population of those who had polio and follow the lot of them. Do you have, though, any data that, for instance, your age of onset, less than 7, more than 7, split only about age 28 to 33? There was very little difference, even though it was statistically significant at the time of the beginning of post-polio symptoms. Do you have any data that actually looks across the whole body of people who developed, who had polio now with regard to those risk factors?
With regard to your first question, we're very fortunate because the next presentation will address that, since they are one of the few places in the world that has access to denominator data. Unfortunately, in presenting data like this at a clinic, the cards are seriously stacked against you in terms of making any type of comparison. So what we're doing, obviously, is looking at all folks who are having some kind of problems and just trying to sort out among those, are there any that seem to be more prone, if you will, to developing problems later on in life. So I'm very delighted that there is, in fact, going to be information on that point because it's terribly relevant. With regard to looking at the whole spectrum of age, I think what you're asking is there a kind of a break point at which age becomes less important? And we've done now these kind of analyses on almost 1,000 people. This group is different from the two other groups because the other group all were based on questionnaire, all self-report, people who had not been examined, and so in whom the question of polio was still really unresolved. And that's why we wanted so much to be able to examine people for ourselves, and they all had EMGs, and the diagnosis of polio was absolutely confirmed, not only by the history, but by EMG and by their clinical exam and so on and so forth. So that we felt fairly confident. But it's interesting that the data from the questionnaire, the self-report study, is very similar. When you pool all that data, it does in fact look like there is somewhat of a linear relationship. We didn't take it from zero age all the way up, but in breaking it down into 5-year chunks, it's quite clear that folks who, for example, fall in the 5 to 10 age group have more problems and have them sooner than the younger group, and so on and so forth, up to 25 or 35 years of age. So there does seem to be a gradual increase. The interesting thing is that when you look at polio in general, in terms of its severity, there is also a relation to age, which is something which is well known by the epidemiologists reporting back in the 40s and 50s. That is to say that people who were younger at onset tended to have milder polio, and those who were older had more severe. So in fact, it could be that age is a confounding variable and not a separate variable. Yes?
Don Sanders, I'm struck by the ratio of the sex ratio of the group that you described here, which considerably differs from previous reports which showed a very strong male predominance. I don't expect you to comment on the previous reports, but do you have any ideas as to why your ratio is so much different?
Well, all I can say is now this represents, if you will, the third study. Again, two separate questionnaire studies. I can tell you that the numbers on the first two were identical to this. That is to say, 2/3 of the people who responded were women. When we opened the doors of the clinic, and obviously we didn't have a special porthole for men and one for women, it turned out two-thirds were women. Now, we know from looking back at the occurrence of polio, it didn't seem to have any strong sex preference. It's true that there was a preference by age, so that if you look, for example, at age-specific rates, that men were more likely, or males were more likely to develop polio in the earlier age groups, 0 to 5, up to 9 or 10. Women were more likely to develop polio in the older age groups, 25 to 39. So we know there's that split. But if you average it out, it looks like it's roughly, you know, 1-to-1 back when they got it. Now you can say something about, well, maybe there are fewer men around because, you know, they have a tendency to die earlier and so on and so forth. But in general, we're not looking at a real old population. I mean, the median age of this group was 46 or so, 45. Likewise, the median age of the other two groups I talked about. So, I don't know. Does someone else in the group... There is a bias, of course, generally acknowledged, I think, that women are more likely to come forward in terms of expressing problems and seeking help. So I think that answers some of the bias you get in questionnaires, and it may answer some of the biases in terms of coming to help.
We have a response to that question.
I'm Sybil Cole, and I was the social worker associated with the post-polio clinic, and Dr. Smith and Dr. Halstead and I thought that one of the reasons that many more of the women were coming at this point in time was because of their increased activity. The majority of these women were married, had raised several children, and also were working outside of the home, so that unlike the male counterpart who came home and relaxed, they then came home to a second job. As reported by the women, in terms of their perception and the way they would not delegate that housekeeping role to other people.
Jasper Dalby's going to comment on that, too.
Thanks, Jasper Dalby. I'd like to, before I ask my question, just ask a couple of quick follow-ups on that. Do you think the same thing is the reason that you only have one black with so many whites? The whites are working harder? Could you explain why the unusual ratio of blacks to whites? And do you have evidence in your questionnaire about the exercise or activity level? If you're going to say it's due to overuse, do you have any evidence that those people who were more active, in fact, were more likely to develop the problem? And after you answer that, then I'd like to ask my question.
The question about the race issue, as I understand it from the old literature, there were, in fact, fewer blacks who were affected. I think part of that could have been a socioeconomic factor. It also could be a socioeconomic factor now, and that is that blacks don't have the same access as others to the healthcare system. This was a private hospital and a private clinic, and there was a need to present some evidence of insurance and so on. With respect to exercise, yes, we did ask the question, but as you may well know, trying to quantitate the amount of exercise retrospectively can be extraordinarily difficult. And I've been involved in retrospective studies of various types, and there are just all kinds of hazards. There's an awful lot of bias in terms of how we remember even what we did yesterday. So I think it's something that needs to be probed. I'm very sorry that Dr. Paffenbarger couldn't be here, because he's one of the few people in the country who has looked at this whole issue prospectively. And when I spoke to him, it was with a specific intent of seeing if he could tease out of some of his data. He's been following now for 30 or more years a fairly large cohort of college graduates from Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania, and he's been looking very specifically at issues including exercise as well as diet and sleep and so on and so forth. But by sending them questionnaires at periodic intervals over 30 years, he has, I think, as good data as one can get. And of course, he's been able to use that to help predict some of the risk factors for coronary artery disease. But he thought that he might be able to go back and identify a few folks in his group. It's not an enormous sample, but a few that had polio, and perhaps tease out that exercise question. So I know if he were here, he would like to respond to that, and I'm looking forward to perhaps getting a response at another time.
My question relates to the pain. The experience you've had is really remarkable with the large number of patients you've looked at, and as all of us who are clinicians do, we attempt to dissect out why is this patient having pain, what's the mechanism of it. Could you generalize about what you think the mechanisms are? Are there one or two? Is this just because joints are being overused? Do you think there's muscle damage that's occurring? But your clinical impression, what's the basis for the pain?
Well, I would separate the joints from the muscles. I get the impression that the joints are hurting because of a wear and tear phenomenon. The muscles, it's a little harder to say. I experience muscle pain myself, and I'm daily trying to figure out what it is. There seems to be a hypersensitivity. There seems to be almost a parasthetic quality to it. It's a pain in my own case, for example, that gets much better with rest, that does better with mild analgesics, does better with heat. Other people will describe it differently. I'm not sure there's a single type of pain. I think there may be different types, and people obviously experience it differently. I'd be anxious to hear other people have observed in their own impressions. But I think we're running out of time.
Rostov, London. I'm not clear in your 132 proven cases that if you took 1,000 unselected polios, and I believe this relates to the last question, how many of the 1,000 unselected polio patients would have the post-polio syndrome?
Probably about 1 in 4. And that's exactly the topic which the folks from Mayo Clinic are going to present in the next paper.
And I would like to suggest that they maybe have 2 diseases rather than 1, but perhaps that can wait till tomorrow.
Yes.
Thank you.
Next paper is going to be presented by 3 individuals. Dr. Mary Codd, who is currently at the Mayo Clinic, but comes from Ireland and is going back there shortly, I believe. Dr. Anthony Windebank, who is on the staff at Mayo Clinic, a neurologist, and Dr. Jasper Dowby. They have divided their topic among them, and because Dr. Larson is not here, we have given them additional time. Their topic is poliomyelitis in Olmsted County, Minnesota, epidemiological, clinical, and electrophysiological evaluation of long-term sequelae.
I'd like to thank Dr. Bradley and Dr. Holstead and Dr. Brostoff for raising the important question of the denominator. What we're trying to do in our study is to look at all patients with polio and find out how many of them are getting into trouble. We're fortunate in Olmsted County in Minnesota because we have a database that's been mechanically or electronically coded since 1935, which allows us access to health information on all of the residents of Olmsted County in Minnesota. And what we've been looking at is all those who had paralytic polio. Very briefly, this has been a team effort between the epidemiology department, the neurology department, the EMG lab, the physical medicine and occupational therapy department, and our pulmonary function labs to try and determine how frequently do people who had paralytic polio, how frequently are they getting into trouble now? What is the nature of their difficulties? Are we dealing with loss of motor neurons? Are we looking at deterioration of joint function? Or are we seeing the effects of other systemic or neurologic diseases? And what we'd like to do is to start by having Mary Codd present the epidemiological database that we're working with.
I think you can just about see me above this podium. Thanks, Tony. Well, the great advantage of being scheduled to talk early in the program is that I get to enjoy the rest of the meeting without the anxiety of an impending presentation. But perhaps the disadvantages are that the audience is fresh and attentive and ready to hang on every word. In addition, I think that in the initial stages of a presentation such as this meeting, the onus is upon the early presenters to set the stage for the meeting and perhaps even to be a little provocative. And I have therefore chosen this first slide as my opening slide. Those of you who read almost any newspaper in the country during the week beginning May 27th, 1984, may recall some of these headlines. There are but a few of the many reports which appeared in the press after the first research symposium on the late effects of polio, which was held here. They served a useful purpose in that they highlighted the problems of the post-polio community, bringing them to the attention of the public as well as the medical and paramedical professions. On the other hand, though, these reports generated a considerable amount of anxiety and indeed panic among post-polio individuals and their relatives everywhere. A number of the participants of that meeting who are here today would testify, I'm sure, to the volume of mail and telephone calls they received from anxious individuals in the ensuing weeks and months after that meeting. We should perhaps think about this vis-a-vis the message or messages that we would wish to be conveyed from this meeting. Could I have the slide off, please? I'm really, at this point, going to address some of the issues which arise in conducting follow-up studies of any medical condition, but in particular of poliomyelitis. The major objective of follow-up studies of polio is the assessment of the frequency and the nature of long-term sequelae. Ideally, one would like to know the current health status and functional status of all surviving post-polio patients. Since this is impractical, a limited answer has been sought and has been provided by the various questionnaire surveys and clinical studies of post-polio patients which have either been completed or are currently in progress. These studies present certain problems, however. Slide on, please. The first of these is one that has already been addressed, and that is selection bias, and really requires very little explanation. I think everyone is agreed that the probability that attendees at a specific clinic or rehab unit, members of a polio support group, are those who selectively respond to questionnaires, that the probability that they are representative of all polio patients is low. They're more likely to over-represent those with the highest level of disability. Moving quickly to the next point, there are two aspects to the issue of the validity of self-reporting. Many people who contracted polio in infancy or childhood, for those, the history of acute polio may be based on a dim recollection which is supplemented by information from relatives. Many have changed their residence and no longer have access to their old records, and regrettably, in many places, old records have been destroyed. And some patients with paralytic polio may not have been hospitalized. So I think that the diagnosis of the acute illness is in certain instances in some doubt. The second aspect to the validity of self-reporting is that of the reporting of current symptomatology, which, where, if at all possible, it's probably desirable to validate that by objective clinical evaluation. Obviously, it's not possible to state on the basis of one examination whether there's been progression or not, i.e. progression from the maximal recovery level. And so ideally, repeated examinations are called into question. And obviously here, one gets into the very thorny issue of cost. The next, number three there, follow-up studies of necessity raise the issue of case definition, i.e. what constitutes a case of post-polio syndrome. And Dr. Halstead has already alluded to certain diagnostic criteria which could be used to define such a case. The symptomatology is so varied that it's difficult to establish criteria for defining a case, and this slide shows suggested criteria which were proposed by Dr. Mulder and colleagues in 1972. These are a credible and preferably documented history of paralytic polio with a partial recovery function. The period of stabilization, obviously, is something that can be a subject for discussion. And then the subsequent development of progressive muscular weakness for which there's no identifiable cause other than polio. I think these are not all-inclusive. They do not necessarily take into consideration those individuals whose primary complaint is of excessive fatigue or those in whom musculoskeletal symptoms predominate. They do perhaps, however, represent a framework from which agreed-upon and acceptable criteria can be developed, such as those that Lara has used in defining the cases in his clinical study. To deal very briefly with the fourth and fifth points there, cross-sectional studies are of value in assessing the frequency of late progression at certain points in time, but of course they're of limited value, or none perhaps, in predicting future trends, and so this highlights the need for continued surveillance in a prospective way. And finally, the nature of the polio epidemics was such that they were unpredictable in time and place. And although we have sources of data from different parts of the country, it's one could legitimately ask, can the results from one center be generalized to the total cohort of paralytic patients currently living? I'm going to move directly now to the epidemiologic study, and some of this information some of you have heard before. This was designed to assess the frequency of late progression of polio in a geographically defined cohort of paralytic polio victims. The centralized diagnostic index at Mayo Clinic, which Dr. Windebank has already spoken about, provides a unique opportunity to conduct population-based research. since the diagnostic information on all residents of Olmsted County has been coded into the system since early in the century. For this study, all histories coded out to poliomyelitis or related disorders were reviewed. They were retrieved and reviewed. And the next slide shows the criteria that were used to define a case. We looked at all cases of acute polio, coded out to acute polio, or reported to the State Health Department during the period 1935 to 59. One of the requirements was that the cases to be included had to be resident in Olmsted County at onset. And finally, that they would conform to the diagnostic criteria for paralytic polio as set forth by the National Conference on Recommended Practices for the Control of Polio. And those criteria probably really don't need to be mentioned, but just to go very quickly through them, the history compatible with polio, fever, meningeal symptoms and signs, and abnormal spinal fluids, in addition to demonstrable muscle weakness or paralysis. However, they have clarified that issue of weakness or paralysis and indicated that it should be weakness which has been detected and persisted during at least two examinations made at intervals of at least several hours. The results of examination for paralysis of extremities or trunk may be very unreliable during the period of muscle tenderness or spasm. Those criteria were applied in defining the cases that we identified in the population of Olmsted County. The results of that are as follows in very abbreviated form. The total cohort is 286 individuals with an age range of less than 1 to 59 years. The median age of this group was 9. The sex ratio was almost equal, a 1.1 predominance of females. This sex ratio is exactly represented in the group which was subsequently selected for clinical examination. The case fatality ratio, there were 30 people who died in the acute phase of the illness, representing a case fatality of 10.5%. I should perhaps mention that in the same time period, there were approximately 150 individuals who were diagnosed as having non-paralytic polio. These were people who had a history of acute febrile illness with abnormal findings on CSF, perhaps some muscle tenderness and spasm, but no demonstrable weakness. There were, in addition, approximately 170 individuals who were termed polio suspects, those people who presented to the emergency room or to their physician with a febrile illness, perhaps some meningeal irritation, but with normal CSF and without any evidence of weakness or paralysis. We have not, at this point in time, included these people in follow-up. We have concerns that they may not necessarily represent the entire group of non-paralytic polio or those who would have had abortive polio. This demonstrates the age and sex-specific incidence rates of polio in that original cohort. And this exactly replicates what Lara has already said in terms of the age distribution of the acute illness and in terms of the sex distribution, in that in the younger age group there appeared to have been a predominance of males, and in the 25 to 39 year age group it tended to occur slightly more commonly in females. This age distribution is also exactly represented a median of 30 years out from the acute illness in the group that has been selected for clinical examination. The total cohort, as I mentioned, is 286. This study has actually been conducted in two parts. It was originally confined to the city of Rochester and has now been extended to include the balance of Olmsted County. I present these results somewhat separately on the follow-up point of view, because the follow-up on the Olmsted patients is still underway and not complete. We're still receiving replies. From the 286 in the far left column, my left, there were 30 deaths in the acute phase, with 23 who died in subsequent years up to the time of follow-up. Of the total 286, there were only 10 individuals for whom we could get no information as to their current vital status or current residence. And to this, I really must attribute the credit to the people who helped me to trace some of these individuals who had left Rochester, Minnesota 40, 50 years ago. There were a total of 223 persons available for follow-up by questionnaire. 161 of those had been previously resident in Rochester, with 62 in Olmsted County. Concentrating on the Rochester group, of the 161, we've had to date 142 replies. In fact, the number of non-respondents, which is 19, includes quite a few who had remained untraced for quite a long period of time and have only just recently been traced and had questionnaires sent. So at the moment, we're looking at an 88% response rate among the Rochester cohort, and we feel confident that we will achieve and perhaps even surpass that with the total cohort when it's complete. A short screening questionnaire, 10 items, was used to ascertain the current health status of these 223 persons who were contacted. This inquired about general health status, but in addition about the current status as far as muscular weakness was concerned, whether it had stayed the same, improved, or worsened since the acute illness, and asking individuals to indicate the year they achieved their maximal recovery, and when they first noticed a change, if such a change had occurred. The results, again, concentrating on, first of all, the Rochester group, we had of 142 respondents, there were three who indicated they did not wish to participate. There were 109 from this group who indicated that they had remained stable or in many cases were continuing to improve since their maximal recovery level from polio. There were 30 who indicated recent deterioration in functional status. That represents a frequency for progression, if that's what one wants to call it, in the Rochester cohort of 22%. It's interesting to note that of the replies we have received to date from the Olmsted group, we have 6 of 24 who indicate that they have disimproved since their maximal recovery level, and the others are quite adamant that they remain stable or continue to improve. Following a detailed telephone interview with this group of 30 who indicated deterioration, it was apparent that some objective assessment in terms of clinical evaluation was desirable in order to clarify the exact frequency, nature, and severity of many of the diverse symptoms that these people reported. Consequently, on the basis of this epidemiologic study in Rochester, funding was requested from the Easterseal Research Foundation to conduct clinical and electromyographic evaluations on a sample of patients. And we are very grateful to the Easterseal Foundation for funding that grant, which enabled us to examine up to 50 individuals if the support was retained exclusively for evaluations. For that reason, we selected for study those survivors from the original cohort who currently reside in Rochester and the surrounding area. One might ask what biases this selection process introduce. In particular, it was of interest to determine whether those with severe involvement at onset were more likely than those with milder involvement to reside permanently in proximity to a medical center such as the Mayo Clinic. It was interesting to note that among both the stable group, 109, and the group indicating deterioration, 30, that one-third in both groups still resided in Rochester. Approximately one-third resided in the rest of Minnesota, and one-third resided elsewhere as far afield as Canada and Australia. Consequently, we had ready access to 30 stable persons, or 30 people from the group indicating stability, and in fact, 8 cases, in quotes. In order to increase the representation of cases, it was decided to include the 11 who resided in the rest of the state of Minnesota, thus giving a total of 19 cases, or approximately two-thirds of those 30. This group of 52 were then invited to participate in the extensive clinical and electromyographic evaluation. And now, to present the results of this study, I'll hand over directly to Dr. Windebank.
Thanks very much, Mary. What I'd like to do is to briefly talk about the design of our study. And Mary showed a slide demonstrating public interest. This slide just demonstrates, this was from our pink sheets from NIH on the first go-round of the grant application that we put into NIH. So there's some difference in the interest in this particular disorder. What we did, as Mary pointed out, was to select from our epidemiological study some patients who were reporting to be progressing, and some patients who said they were stable. And to date, we've actually studied 31 patients, and that's the data that I'm going to present now. Each of these patients was treated in the following way. There was an interview with the patient to determine their eligibility, that is, their residence, and a review of the old record that they had polio. They then went through a detailed questionnaire history, MMPI, creatine kinase blood test, a neurologic examination and disability score, electrophysiological studies, pulmonary function tests, isometric strength recording, and functional tests. All of these were done without any reference to their present history, and that's a very important point, that the neurologist, the EMG-er, did not ask the patient how they were doing until they'd completed all their studies, and then they came back to the neurologist who reviewed with them their questionnaire. Now, the individual components of this is the questionnaire that was given to the patient after they'd signed the consent form, had 337 items and covered 9 pages. The patient completed it, and then when they'd finished all the studies, they came back to the neurologist to make sure the questions were understood, that it was completely filled out, and that the patient responses were what they meant to say. Typical items, this is just one part of the questionnaire, ask questions about their weakness, but also the critical question, the arm weakness has stayed the same since maximal recovery or worsened since maximal recovery. And I'll come back to these key questions later. We also asked many questions about functional ability at maximal recovery and now, again giving us historical data from the patient about how they were at their best and how they're doing now. The patients then went for a neurologic examination. This was performed by one of 2 neurologists. This is the complete examination, but all the results that I'm going to talk about now relate to this muscle examination. And this was, as I say, done without regard to whether the patient thought they were progressing or were stable. We use a different grading system in which we try to delineate a linear scale of mild weakness, moderate weakness, severe, and no movement. That is 25% weak, 50% weak, 75% weak, 100% weak. And all the results that I will refer to will only relate to strength of this group of muscles. Patients underwent pulmonary function tests, the standard tests in our lab, with special reference to maximal inspiratory and expiratory pressures. They went to our biomechanics lab to have isometric strength testing, which we feel will be very important for the follow-up. And in our whole study that we hope to perform, in which we will look at all patients in the Olmsted County District who had polio, we're also going to do extensive studies on their joint function in this same laboratory. But we feel that this strength testing will be very useful for follow-up purposes. This is done with a standard Cybex or a modified Cybex machine for the large muscles, and then using systems developed in our own biomechanics laboratory of computerized measurement of strength. Now, functional tests were also carried out in the occupational therapy department, which involved measurement of muscle bulk in terms of limb girth, time to walk 100 feet, the Minnesota Rate of Manipulation test, and the Crawford Small Parts Dexterity tests. Something to give us an estimate of walking function, lower limb function, and also upper limb function. Now, we also, as I mentioned, carried out the MMPI, which is a standard psychological inventory that you're all familiar with, and a creatine kinase estimation. These patients had detailed electrophysiological studies that Jasper Dauby is going to explain to you in 1 minute. Now, if I put on the data analysis, we're going to look at quantitative data from the present study, but also a review of the old record contemporaneous with their polio. The patients had, all of the patients, a complete neurologic examination, and this is just one page of the neurologic examination. I think this one's from 1944, and if we, for example, look at the muscle part of it, of course you can't read this, but all the muscles recorded their examination for strength using exactly the same grading system that we use now. That's been in use for 70 years at the Mayo Clinic. So we've got documentation of the paralytic illness, a contemporaneous history of the acute illness from the patient and their family. We've got sequential daily neurologic examinations at the time of their illness. We have their spinal fluid results in every case, and we have information from the record about other illnesses that occur. And now I'd like to hand over to Dr. Dowby just to tell us about the electromyographic studies.
Thank you, Tony. You said that I'd present this in 1 minute. Do you mean I've cut me back from 6 minutes to 1 minute?
1 minute from there.
Okay, thank you. He's a tough taskmaster and has us all lined up in order. The goal of the design of the electrophysiologic studies was to perform standard testing on all subjects in search for signs of axonal loss or other diseases. We also try to design it in a way that would be acceptable to patients, both in terms of time and discomfort to the patient. All the studies were completed within or somewhat less than a 2-hour appointment that had been pre-scheduled. The studies were all done by a single electromyographer with the assistance of a technician, and neither had any knowledge of the history or progression of that patient. The patient was first seen by the technician, who reviewed the test with them, both verbally and with a handout, checked the temperature of all limbs and warmed them in a water bath if necessary, and then again explained that there would be no discussion about the disease. Patients tend to want to talk about and tell you about what's going on, and so we had to make a special effort to keep that information from ourselves. We selected nerve conduction studies, and we wanted to limit them somewhat because of the time constraints that I mentioned earlier, to be those that in our experience are the most reliable and most sensitive at detecting the kind of changes we're interested in. We used continuous temperature monitoring of each limb and made appropriate corrections of the temperature if it fell. We used standard surface recordings for all of the nerve conduction studies at standard anatomical locations and distances, and we did all studies bilaterally, that is, both arms and both legs. The sensory nerve conduction studies were designed to look primarily for evidence of other associated diseases. We measured peak-to-peak amplitude of the sensory nerve action potentials, measured onset and peak latencies with stimulation both at the proximal and distal sites, and calculated conduction velocities. The motor conduction studies emphasized in particular the negative peak amplitudes and peak areas. We have an automated system that defines area for us. We feel that this gives us the best estimate quantitatively of loss of muscle, or amount of muscle tissue present. We also looked at distal latency measured to the onset of the response, calculated conduction velocities, and measured the minimal F-wave latencies on 10 reproducible responses. These motor conduction studies were performed bilaterally on the median nerve to the thenar muscle and on the peroneal nerve to the extensor digitorum brevis muscle. On each of these motor conduction studies, we also performed repetitive stimulation, looking for any evidence of ongoing reinnervation. This was done at rates of 2 hertz, giving 4 repetitive shocks and repeating until we had a reproducible response, either of no change or a reproducible decrement. On each of the nerve-muscle combinations, we also used the technique first described by Dr. McComas of motor unit potential counting. We'll hear more about that tomorrow, but it is a method of defining the number of motor units in a group of muscles you're recording from. While the technique has some technical problems associated with it in patients with myopathies or in normals, in our hands, and I believe that we'll hear more about its reliability, in patients with polio who have a reduction in number of motor units, we feel it's a feasible and reliable method of measuring the number of motor units present. We used relatively standard methods, the methods that Dr. McComas originally described. We made the recordings all at gains of 200 microvolts. We used a 10-turn potentiometer on the stimulator to give us small increments of stimulation so we could produce reproducible increments in area of the evoked response. In many patients, we were able to actually count the total number of motor units in that muscle. That is, they were small enough. In those patients in whom it wasn't possible to count all of them, we used the method he described of calculating the total area of the evoked response and dividing it by the average area of those 5 to 10 responses that we were able to record. These were repeated to show that the responses were reproducible in each of the muscles. In addition, we performed needle electromyography. We did this on standard muscles bilaterally in each patient. Each patient had examination of the thenar muscles and the extensor digitorum brevis muscles, and in addition, 2 muscles that were selected by the clinician as muscles that had moderate levels of involvement without the clinician knowing whether there was any evidence of progression in those muscles or not. With the needle examination, we looked for spontaneous activity, signs of denervation, looked for fibrillation potentials in 20 different locations and graded it semi-quantitatively on a scale of 0 to 4. This is our standard grading in our laboratory. Motor unit potential recruitment, which provides evidence, again, semi-quantitatively, of the loss of motor units,
was looked at in terms of the rate of firing versus the number of units that are firing, and also graded on a scale of 0 to 4. The number of turns in a motor unit potential, which provides evidence of either reinnervation or loss of fibers from a unit, as identified by potential direction reversals, was also graded on a scale of 0 to 4. And motor unit potential variation, another sign of ongoing reinnervation, identified as changes in the turns, was identified as either present or absent in each muscle. We elected not to measure other parameters, in part because of the time and discomfort that would be involved. We did not quantitate the size of motor unit potentials, amplitude or duration. It's our sense that this would be less sensitive and is significantly more time consuming. We did not do single fiber EMG because, in fact, the measurements I've described of both variation and potential turns adequately give the same information as single fiber EMG. And our experience and the time it would take to perform macro EMG, which we'll hear more about tomorrow, also resulted in our electing not to use this. All the data was remeasured immediately after its collection and immediately tabulated and put in the record with no discussion with either the patient or the clinician.
Thanks very much, Jasper. And I think it's a tribute to Jasper that none of the patients complained about their electromyographic study when they came back.
This is the end of tape one. Discussion of these papers is on tape two.